Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Angel of Darkness by Caleb Carr. Read by George Guidel.
Chapter 1. June 19th, 1919. There's likely some polished way of starting a story like this. A clever bit of gaming that it'd sucker people in surer than the best banco feeler in town. But the truth is that I haven't got the quick tongue or the slick wit for that kind of game. Words haven't figured much in my life, and though over the years I've met many of what the world counts to be the big thinkers and talkers of our times, I've stayed what most would call a plain man. And so, a plain way of starting will suit me well. The first thing to do along these plain lines is to say why I've closed the shop up and come into the back office on a night when there's still plenty of business that might be done. It's a fine evening, the kind what I used to live for, a night when you can take in all the affairs of the avenue with nothing more than your shirt sleeves for cover, blowing the smoke of a dozen good cigarettes up to the stars above the city, and feeling on balance like maybe there's some point to living in this madhouse after all. The traffic, gasoline-powered automobiles and trucks these days, not just clattering old nags dragging carriages and carts, has slowed quite a bit with the passing of midnight, and soon the after-supper ladies and gents will be over from the Albemarle Hotel and the Hoffman House to pick up their fine blended smokes. They'll wonder why I've closed early, but they won't wonder long before heading for some other shop. And after they've gone, quiet will settle in around this grand flat-iron building with a purpose. She still lords it over Madison Square, the flat-iron does, with her solitary, peculiar silhouette and her fussy stone face, all of which, at the time she was built, had architects and critics going at each other tooth and nail. The Metropolitan Life Tower across the park may be taller, but it doesn't have near the style or presence. And next to the Flatiron, buildings like Madison Square Garden, topped by its once shocking statue of naked Diana, just seem like hangovers from another age, an age that, looking back, feels like it passed in the space of a night. It was a gay night, many folks would say, but for some of us, it was a strange and dangerous time when we learned things about human behavior that most sensible people would never want to know. Even the few that might have been curious got all the grimness they could stand from the Great War. What people want now is a good time, and they want it with a vengeance. Certainly, that drive is what'll be powering the type of folks who'll be on their way over to my shop to try and buy the smokes they'll need for long hours at the city's gaming tables and dance halls. The weather alone would rule out any darker motivations. The breezy, light arms of the night air will wrap themselves around all those keen, hopeful souls, and they'll tear into the town like a meat district dog who smelled out a bit of bone at the bottom of an ash heap. Most of their activities won't amount to nothing, of course, but that doesn't matter. Part of the strange fun of getting rooked into thinking that anything's possible on the beaten, dirty streets of this big onion is knowing that if you don't find what you're looking for tonight, it's all that much more important that you try again tomorrow. I remember that feeling. I had it many times myself before I reached my present lamentable state. Being forever on the verge of coughing up a lung has taken away much of my joy in this existence, for it's hard to relish the world's pleasures when you're leaving pools of blood and pus wherever you go, like some wretched wounded animal. Still, though, my memory's as good as ever. And to be sure, I can recall the raw joy that nights like this used to bring. The feeling of being outside and on your own, with the whole world stretched out and waiting. Yes, even with the hack, I know that you don't come in from a night like this without a damn good reason. But that's exactly what Mr. John Schuyler Moore has given me. He came in about an hour ago, drunk as a lord, which will surprise exactly nobody what knows the man, and spewing a lot of vitriol about the cowardice of editors and publishers and the American people in general. To hear him talk, or maybe I should say to hear the wine and whiskey talk, it's a miracle this country's made it as far as we have, what with all the secret horror, tragedy, and mayhem that infest our society. Mind you, I don't argue the man's point. I spent too many years in the house and employ of Dr. Laszlo Kreitzler, eminent alienist and friend to both me and Mr. Moore, to write my guest's gloomy estimations off as a drunkard's ravings. But, as oftentimes happens with your inebriates, my visitor wasn't going to let his bitterness stay generalized for too long. He was looking for somebody specific to go after. And, in the absence of anybody else, it was pretty obvious that I'd do. His particular complaint had to do with the book he's been writing these last several months, ever since President Roosevelt died. I read the thing, we all did, gave Mr. Moore our thoughts on it, and wished him well. But there wasn't one of us, including the doctor, what seriously believed he had a prayer of finding a publisher for it. The manuscript told the tale of the Beecham murders, the first case that the doctor, Mr. Moore, Miss Sarah Howard, the two detectives Isaacson, Cyrus Montrose, and I had occasion to undertake together. Not the sort of tale that any publisher in his right mind is going to place before the public. True, there's them what likes to get a little scare out of their evening read, but there's also a limit to how far that particular taste goes. And the Beecham tale was as far over that limit as you could likely get in this day and age. Maybe it is a story that needs telling, like Mr. Moore claims. But there's plenty of stories that need telling what never get told just because people can't bear the listening. My first mistake this evening was to make that little observation to Mr. Moore. He gave me what's a rare look for him, hard and truly angry. I've known John Schuyler Moore since I was 11 years old, which would be some 24 years, and I would be hard-pressed to name a fairer, more decent, or generally kinder man. But he does run deep, and like most that do, there's a pool of hurt and bitterness inside him that sometimes can't help but stream on out. I've seen different things bring it on, but it's never been stronger than tonight. He wanted the Beecham story heard, and he was in a genuine rage with all them what were going to prevent him from telling it, not to mention anybody that might even try to understand such skittishness, which in this case, unfortunately, was me. He isn't young any longer, Mr. Moore isn't, and the ruddy ripples of skin around his starched collar tell of how he's lived his life. But in the angry eyes was the same fire that's always driven him when faced with injustice and what he sees as stupidity. And the man doesn't back down at 60-odd years any more than he did when he was my age. Knowing all this, I figured a fine airing of opinions was on its way, and I climbed up one of the wooden ladders in the store to fetch a large jar that contains a particularly pricey mix of Turkish and Georgian leaves. Then I set a second wicker chair out under the little striped canopy that covers my two front windows, S. Taggart, tobacconist, fine foreign and domestic blends, in the best gold leaf, and set to work rolling the goods in my tastiest English papers. In that setting, the two of us had at it, the May breeze continuing to carry the nastier smells of the city off to points east. "So, Stevie," declares the great journalist himself, in the same tone of voice what's gotten him fired off newspapers up and down the East Coast. "I take it that in the end you too are going to prove a willing partner to the conspiracy of silence that surrounds the private horrors of American society." "Have a smoke, Mr. Moore," answers yours truly, the unaware conspirator, "and think about what you just said. This is me, Stevie. The same what has gone on ungodly pursuits like the Beecham case with you since he was a boy." "That's who I thought I was talking to," comments my companion unsteadily, "but your tone led me to wonder if I might not be mistaken." "Light?" says I, whipping a match against my pants as Mr. Moore fumbles in his pockets. "It ain't that you're mistaken," I go on, "but you've got to know how to approach people." "Ah," says he. "And so now I, who have worked for the finest journals in this country, who currently comment on the greatest affairs of the day in the pages of the New York Times, now I do not know how to approach my public." "Don't take on airs," I answers. "The Times given you the sack twice that I know of, exactly because you didn't know how to approach your public. The Beecham case was strong stuff, maybe too strong for your readers to take first horse out of the gate. Could be you should have eased them into it, started with something that didn't involve talk about slaughtered boy whores, cannibalism, and eyeballs in a jar." A smoky hiss comes from the great scribe, and the smallest nod indicates that he thinks maybe I'm right. Maybe the story of a tormented killer who took out his rage on some of the most unfortunate young men in this city wasn't the best way to acquaint people with either the psychological theories of Dr. Kreisler or the secret sins of American society. This realization, if I'm right and he's having it, obviously doesn't set Mr. Moore up much. A deep, whining groan that comes out of him seems to say, "I'm taking professional advice from a petty criminal turned tobacconist." I laugh at this. I have to, for there's more of a pouting child in Mr. Moore's manner now than there is of an enraged old man. "Let's look back on it for a moment," I say, feeling better now that his anger's giving way to a bit of resignation. "Let's think about all those cases and see if we can't find one that might be less of an out-and-out shocker, but still suit the purpose." "It can't be done, Stevie," Mr. Moore mumbles, depressed. "You know as well as I do that the Beecham case was the first and best illustration of the things Kreitzler's been trying to say all these years." "Maybe," I reply. "Then again, maybe there's others as good. You always acknowledged that I had the best memory of all of us. It may be that I can help you think of one." I'm being a little coy here. I already know the case I'd put forward as the most puzzling and fascinating of all we ever worked on. But if I advocate it too fast and with too much vigor, well, it'll just be the rag in front of the bull to a man in Mr. Moore's condition. He produces a flask, is about to take a pull, then jumps a foot or so in the air when a flatbed Ford motor truck backfires like a cannon out in the avenue. Your old folks'll react that way to such things, haven't ever quite got used to the sounds of modern times. Anyway, after he settles back into his chair with a grunt, Mr. Moore allows himself a minute to think my suggestion over. But a slow shake of the head indicates that he's come full circle to the same hopeless conclusion. In all our experiences together, there's nothing as good, nothing as clear, as the Beecham case. I take a deep breath, followed by a drag off my stick, and then I say it quietly. "What about Libby Hatch?" My friend goes a little pale, and looks at me like maybe the old girl herself's going to appear from inside the shop and let him have it if he says the wrong thing. Her name will produce that effect on anyone who ever crossed paths or purposes with her. "Libby Hatch," Mr. Moore echoes quietly. "No, no, you couldn't. It's not... Well, you just couldn't..." He keeps on in that vein until I get enough room in edgewise to ask exactly why you couldn't. "Well," he answers, still sounding like a half-terrified kid, "how could you, how could anyone?" And then some part of his brain that hasn't been clouded by drink remembers that the woman's been dead for better than 20 years. He puffs up his chest and gets a little bolder. "In the first place," he says, and up goes a finger with more at the ready to indicate that there's a whole arsenal of points coming, "I thought you were talking about a story that wouldn't be as gruesome as Beecham's. In the Hatch case, you've not only got kidnappings, but murdered infants, grave robbing, and we did the grave robbing, for God's sake." "True," I say, but there's no buts. Mr. Moore is not letting reason get into this. Up bangs another finger, and he bulls on. "Second, the moral implications," he does love that little phrase, "of the Hatch case are, if anything, even more disturbing than those of the Beecham affair." "That's right," I chime in, "and that's just why—" "And finally," he booms, "even if the story weren't so damned horrifying and disturbing, you, Stevie Taggart, would not be the man to tell it." This point I find a little confusing. It hasn't actually occurred to me that I am the man to tell the story, but I don't much like the statement that I couldn't be. Seems to imply something. Hoping I've taken his meaning wrong, I ask straight out just what's to prevent me from relating the terrible saga of Libby Hatch, if I so desire. Much to my disappointment, Mr. Moore answers that I haven't got the education and I haven't got the training. "What do you think?" he says, his stock of injured pride still not tapped out. "That writing a book's like doing up a sales receipt? That there's nothing more to the author's craft than there is to peddling tobacco?" At this point, I become a little less amused by the inebriate next to me. But I'm going to give him one last chance. "Are you forgetting," I ask quietly, "that Dr. Kreitzler himself saw to my education after I went to live with him?" "A few years of informal training," huffs Mr. Editorial Page. "Nothing to compare to a Harvard education." "Well, you just catch me where I go wrong," I shoot back. "But a Harvard education hasn't done much to get your little manuscript out to the world." His eyes go narrow at that. "Of course," I continue, rubbing the salt in, "I've never taken to liquor, which seems to be the main requirement for gentlemen in your trade. But other than that, I figure I measure up okay against you scribblers." That last word gets some emphasis, being an insult my companion is particularly sensitive to. But I don't overplay it. It's a remark designed not so much to pierce as to sting. And it succeeds. Mr. Moore doesn't say anything for a few seconds. And when he does open his mouth again, I know it's going to be something to equal or outdo my slap. Like two dogs in a pit down in my old neighborhood, we've barked and nipped and sized each other up enough. It's time to go for an ear. "The cowardice and stupidity of New York publishers and the American reading public have nothing to do with any lack of ability on my part in telling the tale," Mr. Moore seethes firmly. "And when the day comes that I can learn something about writing, about Kreitzler's work, or for that matter about anything other than tobacco leaves from you, Taggart, I'll be happy to put on an apron and work your counter for one solid week." Now, you need to know something here. Mr. Moore and me, we are both betting men. I ran my first faro racket when I was 8, for other kids in my neighborhood. And Mr. Moore's always been one to take a flutter on just about any interesting game of chance. Why, it was gambling that formed the first basis of our friendship. The man taught me everything I know about the ponies, and I'll acknowledge as much, even with all his patronizing. So when he makes that last challenge, I don't laugh. I don't shrug it off. I don't do anything but stare him in the eye and say, "Done." And we spit on the wager which I taught him, and we shake on the wager which he taught me. And we both know that's that. He stands, takes a last drag off his butt, and says, "Good night, Stevie," pretty near pleasantly, like none of our earlier conversation ever happened. The whole thing's moved to another level. It's not what he'd call an intellectual exercise anymore, it's a wager. And further talk would only desecrate it. From this point on, there'll just be the playing out of the game, the run to the wire, with one of us ending up a winner and the other a loser. And likely I won't see him much or at all till we know which of us is going to be what. Which leaves me alone for tonight, and, I'm guessing for many nights to come, with my memories of the Hatch case. Of the people what gave us a hand and what got in our way. Of the friends, and more than friends, what were lost to us during the pursuit, of the peculiar places we were led to, and of Libby Hatch herself. And I don't mind saying, now that Mr. Moore's gone and I've had a chance to think it over some, that most of his statements were square on the mark. In many ways, the tale of Libby Hatch was more frightening and disturbing than anything we ran across in our hunt for the butcher, John Beecham. Under ordinary circumstances, in fact, the bumps on my skin and the shivers in my soul that are right now multiplying with my memories might even tempt me to concede the wager. But then the hack starts in. Out of nowhere, rough, racking, shooting bits of blood and God knows what all onto the page before me. And funnily enough, I realize it's the hack that'll keep me writing, no matter what mental jitters I get. Dr. Kreitzler's told me what this cough probably means. I'm not sure how many more years or even months I've got left on this earth. So let Libby Hatch come after me for trying to tell her story. Let her strange, sorry ghost take the breath out of me for daring to reveal this tale. Most likely she'd be doing me a favor. for along with the hack, the memories would end, too. But fate would never be so merciful, and neither would Libby. The only place her memory will haunt are the sheets of paper before me, which will serve not the purposes of a publisher, but to settle a bet. After that I'll leave them behind for whoever happens across them after I'm gone, and cares to take a look. It may horrify you, reader, and it may strike you as too unnatural a story to have ever really happened. That was a word that came up an awful lot during the days the case went on. Unnatural. But my memory hasn't faded with my lungs, and you can take this from me. If the story of Libby Hatch teaches us anything at all, it's that nature's domain includes every form of what society calls unnatural behavior. That in fact, just as Dr. Kreitzler has always said, there's nothing truly natural or unnatural under the sun. Chapter 2. It was a scratching sound that started it all. The light scrape of a boot against the stone and brick face of Dr. Kreitzler's house at 283 East 17th Street. The noise, familiar to any boy who'd had a childhood like mine, drifted through the window of my room late on the night of Sunday, June 20th, 1897, 22 years ago, almost to the day. I was lying on my small bed trying to study, but without much luck. That evening, too, was far too charged with the breezes and smells of spring and too bathed in moonlight to let serious thinking, or even sleeping, be an option. As was and is too often the case in New York, early spring had been wet and cold, making it fairly certain that we'd get only a week or two of tolerable weather before the serious heat set in. That particular Sunday had been a rainy one earlier on, but the night was beginning to clear and seemed to promise the onset of those few precious balmy days. So if you say that I caught the sound outside my window partly because I was just waiting for some excuse to get outside, I won't deny it. But the larger truth is that ever since I can remember, I've kept careful track of night noises in whatever place I happen to find myself. My room in the doctor's house was up top on the fourth floor, 2 stories and a half a world away from his splendid parlor and dining room below, and another 12 vertical feet from his stately but somehow spare bedroom and overstuffed study on the third floor. Up on the dormered plainness of the top story, what most folks would write off as the servants' quarters, Cyrus Montrose, who split the doctor's driving and other household duties with me, had the big room at the back, and off of that was a smaller room, what we used for storage. My room was at the front, and not near as big as the rear one, but then I wasn't near as big as Cyrus, who stood well over 6 feet tall. And the front space was still plenty plush by the standards of a 13-year-old boy who'd been used to, in order, since birth, sharing a 1-room rear tenement flat near Five Points with his mother and her string of men, sleeping on whatever patches of sidewalk or alleyway offered a few hours' peace, having first left said mother and men at age 3 and for good at age 8, and then fighting his way out of a cell in what the bulls laughingly liked to call the barracks of the boys' house of refuge on Randall's Island. Speaking of that miserable place, I might as well get one thing straight right now, being as it may make a few other things clearer as we go along. Some of you might have read in the papers that I near killed a guard what tried to bugger me while I was confined on the island. And don't think me cold-hearted when I say that in some respects I still wish I had killed him, for he'd done the same to other boys, and I'm certain went on doing it after my case was swept under the rug and he was reinstated. Maybe that makes me sound bitter, I don't know. I wouldn't like to think of myself as a bitter man. But I do find that the things that angered me as a boy still rankle all these years later. So if it seems that some of what I'll have to say in the pages to come doesn't reflect the mellowing of age, that's only because I've never found that life and memories respond to time the way that tobacco does. There was only one other room on the top floor of Dr. Kreitzler's residence, though for all the practical purposes of the household, the chamber had long since ceased to exist. Removed from Cyrus's and my rooms by its own short hallway, it was usually occupied by the maid of the house. But for a full year, it had been uninhabited by any living soul. I say, by any living soul, because it was, in fact, still occupied by the few sad possessions and the even sadder memory of Mary Palmer, whose death during the Beecham case had broken the doctor's heart. Since that time, we in the house had been served by a number of cooks and maids who came before breakfast and left after dinner, some of them capable, some of them downright disastrous. But neither Cyrus nor I ever complained about the turnover, for we had no more interest than the doctor did in taking on somebody permanent. You see, the both of us, though in very different ways from the doctor, of course, had loved Mary, too. Anyway, at about 11 p.m. on that June 20th, I was in my room attempting to read some of the lessons Dr. Kreitzler had assigned to me for that week, exercises in numbers and readings in history, when I heard the front door downstairs close. I felt my body tense the way it always did, and still does, when I hear the sound of a door at night. And then, listening, I made out one heavy, strong set of footsteps on the blue and green Persian carpet of the stairway. I relaxed. Cyrus's gait was as recognizable as the deep breathing and gentle humming that always accompanied it. I fell back under my bed and held my book at arm's length above me, knowing that my friend would soon poke his broad black head in to check on me, and waiting for him to do so. "Everything quiet, Stevie?" he asked when he reached my room in that low rumble that was at once powerful and gentle. I nodded, then looked over at him. "He's staying at the Institute, I guess." Cyrus returned my nod. "His last night for a while. Wants to make use of what time he's got." There was a quiet, worried pause, and then Cyrus yawned. "Don't be up too late now. He wants you to fetch him in the morning. I brought the barouche back. You'll want to take the calash and give one of the horses a rest."
"Right."
Then I heard those heavy feet and legs lumber off toward the back of the house, and the sound of Cyrus's door closing. I set my book down and took to staring blankly first at the simple blue-and-white striped wallpaper around me, then at the small dormered window at the foot of my bed, out of which I could see the rustling leafy tops of the trees in Stuyvesant Park across the street. It didn't make any more sense to me then than it does now, how life can pile troubles up on a man what don't deserve them, while letting some of the biggest jackasses and scoundrels alive waltz their way through long, untroubled existences. I could see the doctor at that moment clear as if I was standing next to him down at the Institute, that being the Kreitzler Institute for Children on East Broadway. He'd long since have made sure the kids were all bedded down safe, as well as given late-night instructions to the staff about any new arrivals or troublesome cases, and by now he'd be at the big secretary in his consulting room, working on a mountain of papers, partly out of necessity and partly to avoid the thought that it all might be coming to an end. He'd stay there under the glow of his green and gold Tiffany lamp, pulling at his mustache and the small patch of beard under his mouth, and occasionally rubbing his bad left arm, which seemed to bother him at night worse than other times. But it'd likely be many hours before weariness began to show in those sharp black eyes, and if he did manage to get some sleep, it would only be when he laid his long black hair on the papers before him and dozed off fitfully. You see, it had been a year of tragedy and controversy for the doctor, beginning, as I've said, with the death of the only woman he'd ever truly loved, and coming to a head with the recent unexplained suicide of one of his young charges at the Institute. A court hearing to discuss the general state of affairs at the Institute had followed this last incident, resulting in an injunction. For 60 days the doctor was to keep clear of the place while the police investigated the matter, and those 60 days were set to start the next morning. However, I'll have much more to say about all that later. It was while I was lying there counting the doctor's troubles that I heard the small, sudden scraping noise I've mentioned coming from outside my window. Like I say, I made the sound right away. My own feet had produced it too many times for me not to. As my heart began to race with a little nervousness but even more excitement, I thought for a second of fetching Cyrus. But then a quick succession of amateur slips in the climbing steps outside made me realize I wasn't about to get a visit from anybody I couldn't handle. So I just set my book aside, slid over to the window, and poked the top of my head out. It makes me smile sometimes to think back on those days, and even more on those nights, and realize just how much time we all spent crawling around rooftops and into and out of other people's windows while most of the city was sound asleep. It wasn't a surprising or new activity for me, of course. My mother had put me to work breaking into houses and lifting fenceable goods as soon as I could walk. But the image of the doctor's respectable young society friends jimmying windows and cramming themselves through them like a batch of garden variety second-story men, well, I did and do find it amusing. And nothing ever gave me a bigger smile than what I saw that night. It was Miss Sarah Howard, busting just about every rule in the Housebreaker's Bible, if there ever was such a thing, and cursing heaven like a sailor all the while. She had on her usual daytime rig, a simple dark dress without a lot of fussy, fashionable undergarments, but uncomplicated as her clothes were, she was having a hell of a time keeping a grip on the rain gutter and the protruding cornerstones of the house, and was a rat's ass away from falling into the doctor's front yard and breaking what would most likely have been every bone in her body. Her hair had obviously started out in a tight bun, but it was coming undone along with the rest of her, and her pretty, if somewhat plain, face was a picture of heated frustration. "You're lucky I'm not the cops, Miss Howard," I said, crawling out onto the windowsill. That brought a quick turn of her head and a burning light into her green eyes that any emerald would have envied. "They'd have you out at the Octagon Tower before breakfast." The Octagon Tower was an evil-looking, domed structure on Blackwell's Island in the East River, one what, along with two wings that branched off of it, made up the city's notorious women's prison and madhouse. Miss Howard only frowned and nodded at her feet. "It's these blasted boots," she said. And looking down at them with her, I could see what the problem was. Instead of wearing a sensible, light pair of shoes or slippers that would have let her get her toes into the gaps in the masonry, she, being a novice, had put on a pair of heavy, nail-studded climber's boots. They weren't unlike the ones the murderer John Beecham had used to climb walls, and I figured that was where she'd got the idea. "You need rope and gear for those," I said, grabbing hold of the window frame with my right hand and extending my left arm to her. "Remember, Beecham was climbing sheer brick walls, and," I added with a smile as I pulled her onto the windowsill with me, "he knew what he was doing." She settled in, caught her breath, and just barely glanced at me sideways. "That's a low blow, Stevie," she said. But then the irritated face turned amused, in the way that her looks and moods always changed suddenly with the speed of a doused cat. She smiled back at me. "Got a cigarette?" "Like a dog has fleas," I said, reaching inside the room for a packet and handing her one. I took one for myself, struck a match on the windowsill, and we both lit up. "Life must be getting boring over on Broadway." "Just the opposite," she said, blowing smoke out toward the park and producing a pair of more conventional shoes from a satchel that was hanging around her neck. "I think I finally got a case that doesn't involve an unfaithful husband or a rich brat gone bad." A word of explanation here. After the Beecham case, all the members of our little band of investigators, besides Miss Howard, had gone back to their usual pursuits. Mr. Moore had gotten his old job back doing criminal reporting for the Times, though he continued to butt heads with his editors as often as ever. Lucius and Marcus Isaacson, meanwhile, had gone back to the police department, where, having been promoted by Commissioner Roosevelt, they were promptly demoted back to detective sergeants when Mr. Roosevelt left for Washington to become Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and the New York Police Department fell back into its old ways. Dr. Kreitzler had returned to the Institute and his consultation work on criminal cases, and Cyrus and me had gone back to running the doctor's house. But Miss Howard couldn't face returning to the life of a secretary, even if it was at police headquarters. So she'd taken over the lease at our former headquarters at No. 808 Broadway and opened her own private investigation service. She limited her clients to women, who generally had a hard time securing such services in those days, not that it's any easy trick for them now. The problem was that, as she'd just said, about the only ladies who could afford to hire her tended to be biddies from uptown who wanted to know if their husbands were cheating on them, the answer generally being yes, or what the wayward heirs to their family fortunes were doing with their private time. In a year of business, Miss Howard hadn't been involved in a single juicy murder case or even a nice, sordid bit of blackmailing. And I think she'd begun to get disenchanted with the whole detecting business. Tonight, though, her face reflected her statement that something genuinely racy might have come her way. "Well," I said, "if it's so important, you could have tried the front door. Would have saved you some time. Lot less chance of breaking your neck, too." Now, if any grown man had made a crack like that to Sarah Howard, she'd have whipped out the derringer that was always hidden somewhere on her person and situated it uncomfortably close to his nose. But probably because I was so much younger, she'd always been different with me and we could talk straight. "I know," she answered, laughing a bit at herself as she took off the nail-studded boots, shoved them into her satchel, and put on the more sensible footwear. "I just thought I could use the practice. If you're going to catch criminals, you've got to be a bit of one yourself, I found." "Ain't that so?" Miss Howard finished tying her laces, rubbed out her cigarette, and scattered the tobacco in the butt on the wind. Then rolled the remaining paper into a tight little ball and flicked it away. "Now then, Dr. Kreitzler's not here, is he, Stevie?" "Not a chance," I answered. "Down at the Institute. Gotta be out by tomorrow morning." "Yes, I know." Miss Howard bent her head in heartfelt sympathy and sorrow. "He must be crushed," she added quietly. "That and more. Almost as bad as, well, you know." "Yes." The green eyes turned toward the park with a faraway look in them, and then she shook herself hard. "Well, with the doctor away, you and Cyrus will be free to give me a hand, if you're willing." "Where are we going?" "Mr. Moore's apartments," she said, doing her hair back into its usual bun. "He's not answering his doorbell or his telephone." "Probably not home, then. You know Mr. Moore. You should get over to the Tenderloin, check the gaming houses. His grandmother's only been dead 6 months. He can't have lost all his inheritance yet." Miss Howard shook her head. "The man at the door to his building says that John came in over an hour ago with a young lady. They haven't left again." A small, mischievous smile came into her face. "He's home, all right. He just doesn't want any interruptions. You, however, are going to get us in." For the briefest moment I thought of the doctor, of how he'd been trying hard to discourage me from my lifelong tendency to get into the kind of goings-on what Miss Howard was currently suggesting. But like I say, my moment of consideration was brief. "Cyrus just came in," I said, returning her smile. "He'll be game. This house has been like a morgue these days. We could use a little fun." Her smile grew into a grin. "Good. I knew I had the right man for the job, Stevie." I nodded. "Yeah," I said, crawling back inside the room. "You just had the wrong shoes." Miss Howard laughed once more and took a swipe at me as we headed in to rouse Cyrus. I hadn't been wrong in thinking that after a year of things going badly in the 17th Street house, Cyrus would be ready for something that might break the routine. In a matter of seconds he was back in his light tweed suit, starched shirt and tie, and as we headed down to the front door, he pulled his favorite old bowler onto his head. The pair of us listened as Miss Howard explained that it was urgent we get Mr. Moore to number 808 Broadway, where a lady in great distress was waiting for her return. The matter, Miss Howard declared, had not only criminal but quite possibly international implications. More than that, she didn't want to tell us just yet, and more than that, neither me nor Cyrus needed to know. What we wanted was a bit of action, and we both knew from personal experience that, given our guide, we were likely to get it. Lengthy explanations could wait. We fairly shot through the foyer and out into the iron-fenced front yard, Cyrus, ever the careful one, pausing just long enough to make sure the house was securely locked up before we made our way down the small path to the gate, started west on the sidewalk of 17th Street, then turned north on 3rd Avenue. There was no point in either getting the horses and Baruch back out of the small carriage house next door or wasting time trying to hail a cab, as it wasn't but 4½ blocks walk to number 34 Gramercy Park, where Mr. Moore had taken apartments at the beginning of the year, after his grandmother's death. As we moved from one circle of arc light to another under the street lamps that ran up Third, passing by simple 3- and 4-story buildings and under the occasional sidewalk-wide awning of a grocery or vegetable stand, Miss Howard locked her arms into Cyrus's right and my left and began to comment on the little bits of night activity that we saw along the way, plainly trying to control her excitement by talking of nothing in particular. Cyrus and I said little in reply, and before we knew it, we'd turned onto 20th Street and reached the brownstone mass of number 34 Gramercy Park, the square bay and turret windows of a few of its apartments still aglow with gas and electric light. It was one of the oldest apartment houses in the city, and also one of the first of the kind they called cooperative, meaning that all the tenants shared ownership. After his grandmother's sudden death, Mr. Moore had given some thought to moving into one of the fashionable apartment houses uptown, the Dakota or such, but in the end I don't think he could face moving so far away from the neighborhoods of his youth. Having lost the second of the only two members of his family he'd ever been close to, the other, his brother, had fallen off a boat after jabbing himself full of morphine and drinking himself senseless many years earlier, Mr. Moore had tried hard to keep ownership of his grandmother's house on Washington Square, but her will had stated that the place had to be sold and the proceeds divided up among her squabbling blue-blood heirs. Being suddenly and completely on his own in such a deep way was confusing enough for Mr. Moore without venturing into unknown neighborhoods. In the end, he came back to Gramercy Park, to the area where he'd grown up and where he'd learned his first lessons about the seamier side of life while slumming as a teenager over in the gas house district to the east. As we started up the steps to the brown marble columns that surrounded the stained glass of the building's entrance, I kept a sharp eye on the shadowy stretch of trees, hedges, and pathways, 2 blocks wide, 1 block long, that was Gramercy Park behind us. Oh, it was surrounded by wealthy houses and private clubs like the Players, sure enough, and was enclosed by a wrought-iron fence some 6 or 7 feet high to boot. But any gas house tough worth his salt could have made short work of that fence and used the park as a hiding place from which to jump unsuspecting passers-by. It wasn't until I saw a cop walking his beat that I felt all right about turning away from that dark mass and joining Cyrus and Miss Howard at the door. It was locked up tight at that hour, but there was a small electrical button set in the frame. Miss Howard put a finger to it, and then we heard a bell ring somewhere inside. Soon I could make out a small form moving slowly our way behind the stained glass, and in another few seconds we were faced by an old gent in a striped vest and black pants who looked like somebody should have buried him about 10 years back. His wrinkled face turned sour at the sight of us.
"Really, Miss Howard, this is most irregular," he grumbled in a hoarse, wheezing voice. "Most irregular. If Mr. Moore does not answer his bell, then I am certain—"
"It's all right, Stevenson," Miss Howard answered, cool as ice. "I've reached Mr. Moore by telephone, and he's told my friends and me to come up. Apparently there's some problem with the bell. He's told me where he's hidden his spare key in the event it happens again."
The old corpse took a long, snooty look at Cyrus and me.
"Has he indeed?" he mumbled. "Well, I'm sure I won't be held responsible if there's anything untoward about this. Most irregular. But—"
he turned toward the elevator door behind him.
"You'd better come on, then."
We followed the man as he pulled open first the outer wooden door and then the inner metal grate of the plush elevator. Taking a seat on the little cubicle's velvet-pillowed bench just to tick the old doorman off, successfully, I studied the polished mahogany and brass around me, wondering what poor soul had to spend half his life keeping it in that shape. If it was the old man in front of us, I allowed as he had good reason for his cantankerousness. Closing the grate and then the door again, the man put on a pair of worn, stained leather gloves and then gave a hard tug on the elevator's greased cable,
which came up through the floor and ran on through the ceiling in one corner to set the thing into motion. We began a gentle glide up to the fifth floor, where Mr. Moore occupied the apartments that faced the park on the building's north side. When the grate and door clattered open again, Cyrus and I followed Miss Howard down a beige-painted hall that was interrupted at various points by still more polished wood doors. Arriving at Mr. Moore's, Miss Howard knocked and then made like she was waiting for Mr. Moore to open up. Turning to the doorman, who was continuing to watch us carefully, she said, "It's late, Stevenson. We mustn't keep you up." The doorman nodded reluctantly, closed the elevator up again, and headed back down. As soon as he was gone, Miss Howard put an ear to the door, then looked at me with those green eyes dancing. "All right, Stevie," she whispered, "you're on." Reformed as I may have become since moving in with Dr. Kreitzler 2 years earlier, I still carried some of the tools of my old trade with me, as they could on occasion come in handy. Among these was my little set of picks, with which I proceeded to make short work of the fairly simple tumblers inside the lock in Mr. Moore's door. With a gentle little click, the door popped ajar, and Miss Howard beamed with delight. "You really have got to teach me that," she murmured, patting my back silently and pushing the door farther open. "Now then, here we go." Mr. Moore had decorated his apartments with as much of his grandmother's furniture as his family would let him get away with, as well as with some fine English country pieces, what Dr. Kreitzler had helped him select. So the place had a kind of split character about it, feeling in some spots like an old lady's house, and in others like a rugged bachelor flat. There were some 7 rooms in all, arranged in a kind of crazy order that wouldn't have made much sense in a regular house. In a stealthy little file, we made our way down the darkened main hall, being careful to stay on the runner carpet all the while, and as we did, we began to come across various articles of men's and women's clothing. Miss Howard frowned when she saw all this, and her frown only got deeper when, as we got close to the bedroom door, we began to hear giggling and laughter coming from inside. Drawing up in front of the door, Miss Howard balled one hand into a fist and made ready to give it a good rap, but then the door suddenly opened, and out popped a woman. And this was, I can say now, with even more appreciation than I could then, a woman, with long golden hair that hung down to her waist and robed in only a coverlet that she clasped with one hand at her side. She had a set of stems on her what started in a pair of slender ankles and didn't seem to end till somewhere up around the ceiling. And the ceilings in that building were high, mind you. She was still giggling as she came out, and we could hear Mr. Moore inside the room pleading with her to come back. "I will, John, I will," the woman said melodiously through rich red lips. "But you must give me a moment." She closed the door again, turned toward the bathroom, what was situated down at the end of the hall, and then caught sight of us. She didn't say anything, just gave us a sort of puzzled little smile. Miss Howard smiled back, though I could see it was a struggle for her, and then held one finger to her lips, urging the woman to be quiet. The woman aped the same gesture, giggled once more, she was obviously drunk, and then continued, without any further word of explanation from or to us, on her way to the bathroom. At that, Miss Howard smiled much more genuinely, not to mention a little wickedly, and opened the bedroom door. The dim light from the hall didn't let us see much more than a jumbled mass of sheets on a very large bed, though it was clear there was a person under the mass. Cyrus and I stayed by the door, but Miss Howard just strode right on up to the bedside, standing there like she was waiting for something. Pretty soon the mass under the sheets started to move, and then the top half of Mr. Moore's naked body appeared, his short hair tousled, his handsome face a picture of happiness. His eyes were closed, and in a kind of childlike way he reached out and put his arms around Miss Howard's waist. She didn't look too happy about it, but she didn't move either, and then, feeling her dress, Mr. Moore mumbled, "No, no, Lily, you can't get dressed. You can't leave. This night can't ever end." That brought out the derringer. To this day, I can't tell you where it was that Miss Howard managed to keep it so that it was always out of sight, yet always so available. But in a flash, it was in front of Mr. Moore's closed eyes and smiling face. The smile disappeared, and the eyes popped open, however, when Miss Howard pulled back the hammer. "I think, John," she said evenly, "that even through the sheets I could clip off both your testicles with one shot, so I advise you to unhand me." Mr. Moore darted away from her with a shriek, then covered himself completely with the sheet like a kid who'd just been caught abusing himself. "Sarah," he shouted, half in fear and half in anger, "what the hell do you think you're doing? And how the hell did you get in here?"
"The front door," Miss Howard answered simply, as the derringer disappeared into the folds of her dress again.
"The front door," Mr. Moore bellowed, "but the front door's locked. I'm sure I—" Looking to the doorway, Mr. Moore caught sight first of Cyrus and then of me, and that was all he needed to see. "Stevie! So!" Patting his hair down onto his head and trying to compose himself, Mr. Moore stood, still covered in his sheet, and drew up to the fullest height he could manage. "I would have thought, Taggart, that the bonds of male honor would have prevented you from playing a part in a scheme like this. And what have you done with Lily?"
"She's in the bathroom," Miss Howard answered. "Didn't seem at all disappointed to see us. You must be losing your touch, John."
Mr. Moore only frowned and looked to the doorway again. "I shall direct my comments to you, Cyrus. Knowing you to be a person of integrity, I can assume that there is some good reason for your being here." Cyrus nodded with the ever so slightly patronizing smile that often came onto his face when he spoke to Mr. Moore. "Miss Howard says there is, sir," he answered. "That's good enough for me. You'd better ask her about it."
"And supposing I don't wish to speak to her?" Mr. Moore grunted.
"Then, sir, you'll be a long time getting an explanation."
Faced with no other option, Mr. Moore paused, shrugged his shoulders, then plopped down onto the bed again.
"All right, Sarah. Tell me what's so all-fired important that it's got you breaking and entering. And for God's sake, Stevie, give me a cigarette."
As I lit up a stick and handed it to Mr. Moore, Miss Howard moved around in front of him.
"I have a case, John."
Mr. Moore let out a big, smoky sigh. "Splendid. Do you demand the front page, or will the inside of the paper do?"
"No, John," Miss Howard said earnestly. "I think this is real. I think it's big."
Her tone took a good bit of the sarcasm out of Mr. Moore's voice.
"Well, what is it?"
"A woman came to number 808 this evening. Senora Isabella Linares. Ring a bell?"
Mr. Moore rubbed his forehead hard.
"No. Which gives her something in common with you. Come on, Sarah, no games. Who is she?"
"Her husband," Miss Howard answered, "is Senor Narciso Linares. Now does that ring a bell?"
Mr. Moore looked up slowly, intrigued in a way that clearly pleased Miss Howard.
"Isn't he? He holds some position in the Spanish consulate, doesn't he?"
"He is, in fact, private secretary to the Spanish consul."
"All right. So what's his wife doing at number 808?
Miss Howard began to pace around the room purposefully. "She has a 14-month-old daughter. Or had. The child was kidnapped 3 days ago." Mr. Moore's face turned skeptical.
"Sarah, we are talking about the daughter of the private secretary of the consul of the Empire of Spain in the city of New York. The same Empire of Spain that Mr. William Randolph Hearst, our friend in the Navy Department, by which he meant Mr. Roosevelt, certain of my bosses, some of the business leaders, and much of the populace of this country have been openly insulting and trying to goad into war for years now. Do you honestly think that if such a child were to be kidnapped in New York, said Empire of Spain would not make the most of the chance to cry foul and declare the barbarity of its American critics? Wars have been fought and avoided over less, you know."
"That's just the point, John."
As Miss Howard went on, both Cyrus and I drew closer, now very interested in what she was saying and not wanting to miss a trick.
"You would think that the Spanish officials would react that way, wouldn't you? But not at all. Señora Linares claims that the kidnapping occurred when she was walking alone with the baby in Central Park one evening. She couldn't see the abductor. He came from behind and hit her on the head with something.
But when she went home to tell her husband what had happened, he reacted strangely, bizarrely. He showed little concern for his wife and less for his daughter. He told her that she must tell no one what had happened. They would wait for a ransom note, and if none came, it would mean that the child had been taken by a lunatic and killed. Mr. Moore shrugged. Such things do happen, Sarah. But he didn't even try going to the police. A full day passed, no ransom note came, and finally Senora Linares declared that if her husband wouldn't go to the authorities, she would. Miss Howard paused, wringing her hands a bit. He beat her, John. Savagely. You should see her. In fact, you're going to see her. She didn't know what to do. Her husband said he'd do worse if she ever talked of going to the police again. Finally, she confided in a friend of hers at the French consulate, a woman I helped out with some minor marital rubbish a few months ago. The Frenchwoman told her about me. The Senora's waiting for us. You've got to come and talk to her. Wait, wait, wait now, Mr. Moore answered, holding up his cigarette and trying to salvage his night of pleasure. You're forgetting a few things here. In the first place, these people are diplomatic officials. The laws are different. I don't know exactly what they are in a case like this, but they're different. Second, if this Linares character doesn't want to pursue it, then who are we to— Mr. Moore was interrupted by the sudden appearance, behind Cyrus and me, of the woman he'd just minutes ago been in bed with. She'd apparently retrieved her clothes from the hall and was fully dressed and ready to depart. "Excuse me, John," she said quietly. "I wasn't sure what these people wanted, but it does sound important, so I thought I ought to go. I'll see myself out." She turned to leave, and Mr. Moore suddenly looked like he'd done a few seconds in the electrical chair. He cried, "No!" desperately, secured his sheet around himself again, and bolted toward the bedroom door. "No, Lily, wait. Call me at the theater tomorrow," the woman answered from the front door. "I'd love to take this up again sometime." And with that, she was gone. Mr. Moore stalked over to Miss Howard and glared at her what you might call hotly. "You, Sarah Howard, have just destroyed what was well on its way to becoming one of the three best nights of my life." Miss Howard only smiled a bit. "I won't ask what the other two were. No, really, I am sorry, John, but this situation is desperate." "It had better be." "It is, trust me. You haven't heard the best part yet." "Oh, haven't I?" "Senora Linares came to me in the greatest secrecy after normal business hours. In order to make sure that she wasn't followed by anyone from the consulate, she took the 3rd Avenue L downtown. When she got off the train at 9th Street, she walked along the platform toward the stairs down to the street, and happened to glance into the last car of the train." Miss Howard stopped for a moment, causing Mr. Moore to get a bit agitated. "Sarah, you can dispense with all these dramatic pauses. They're not going to improve my mood. What did she see?"
"She saw her child, John."
Mr. Moore's face screwed up. "You mean she thought she saw her child? Wishful thinking, that kind of thing."
"No, John. Her child. In the arms of a woman."
Miss Howard allowed herself one more smiling pause.
"A white American woman."
Mr. Moore digested that little tidbit with a kind of tormented but interested moan. The newshound was winning out over the libertine. He turned to me, still not looking much happier, but clearly resigned to his fate. "Stevie, as a means of atoning for this invasion, will you help me find my clothes? Then we'll get down to number 808 and, God willing, find out what this is all about. But so help me, Sarah. Derringer or no Derringer, if this case is a bust, you will regret the day we ever met."
"Oh, I regretted that ages ago," Miss Howard answered with a laugh, one that Cyrus and I picked up on. "Come on, Stevie, let's see if we can't get our distraught friend here cleaned up. We need to move quickly."
Chapter 3. It was a walk I hadn't made in a year, that down to number 808 Broadway, but you wouldn't have known it from the way my body moved along the route. I remember reading in The Principles of Psychology, that doorstop of a book what Dr. Chrysler's old teacher at Harvard, Professor William James, had written some years back, and which I'd fought my way through along with the rest of our team during the Beecham case, that the brain isn't the only organ that stores memories. Some of the more primitive parts of the body, muscles for instance, have their own ways of filing away experience and recalling it at a moment's notice. If so, my legs were proving it that night, for I could have made the trip even if somebody's cut my spinal cord below the cerebral cortex and left me running on nothing but my brainstem, like one of those poor laboratory frogs what Professor James and his students seem to be always chopping into little pieces. As we made our way along Gramercy Park and then down Irving Place, I once again kept a sharp eye out for any gas house boys what might be out to pick off drunken swells who were on their way home from the gaming houses of the Tenderloin. But there wasn't any trouble hanging in the air, just the same moist, clean scent that had followed the day's rain, and as we moved south I began to loosen up. Miss Howard still didn't want to divulge any more information concerning her case until we got to number 808 and actually met the lady in question. So our efforts were applied with singleness of purpose to getting Mr. Moore to that location. This job was a little trickier than it might sound. We'd chosen to go downtown on Irving Place because we knew that if we headed over to 4th Avenue and then south to Union Square, we'd pass by Brubaker's Wine Garden, where many of Mr. Moore's drinking pals would doubtless still be engaged in the customary activity of that establishment, laying bets on whether or not passing pedestrians, carriages, and carts would be able to successfully avoid grievous collisions with the streetcars what came screaming down Broadway and tearing around the square at top speed. Faced with such a temptation, Mr. Moore would likely have proved unable to resist. But Irving Place had its own distraction in the form of Pete's Tavern at 18th Street, a cozy old watering hole what had once been a favorite retreat of Boss Tweed and his Tammany boys, and where in recent days Mr. Moore could often be found passing the evening with several of his journalistic and literary friends. Once the glowing orange lights in the smoky windows of Pete's were behind us, however, I could tell that Mr. Moore knew his last chance for salvation had also passed. His grumbling took a decided turn toward whining. "I mean to say, tomorrow is Monday, Sarah," he protested as we reached 14th Street. The deceptively chipper front of Tammany Hall rose into view on our left, looking the way it always did to me, like some crazy giant brick wardrobe. "And keeping up with what Croker and those swine are doing," Mr. Moore pointed toward the hall, "requires constant and irritating effort, not to mention the Spanish business."
"Nonsense, John," Miss Howard replied snappily. "Politics in this city are dead in the water right now, and you know it. Strong's as lame a duck as ever sat in City Hall, and neither Croker nor Platt," by which she meant the Democratic and Republican bosses of New York, respectively, "is about to let another reform mayor win in November. Come this winter, it's going to be back to business as filthy usual in this city, and nobody needs you to tell them so." As if to punctuate Miss Howard's point, a sudden roar of laughter cut through the night as we waded through the rain-thinned horse manure and urine that coated 14th Street. Once across, we all turned around to see a small crowd of well-dressed, drunk, and very happy men emerging from Tammany Hall, a fat cigar sticking out of each of their mouths. Mr. Moore noised in some discouragement, watching the men as he followed the rest of us west. "I'm not sure it's quite that simple, Sarah, and even if it is, that doesn't clear up the larger issue of the Cuban crisis. We're at a critical point in our dealings with Madrid."
"Hogwash."
Miss Howard paused just long enough to grab Mr. Moore's sleeve and pull him along faster.
"Even if your area were foreign rather than metropolitan affairs, you'd be stymied for the moment."
"General Woodford," referring to the new American minister to Spain, "hasn't even left for Madrid yet, and McKinley doesn't intend to send him until he's gotten a full report from the special envoy to Cuba. What's his name? That man Calhoun."
"How the hell," Mr. Moore mumbled despondently, "am I supposed to argue with a girl who reads more of my damned paper than I do?"
"All of which," Miss Howard finished up, "means that you'll have nothing more to occupy your attention at the office tomorrow than the usual run of summer violence. Oh, and there's Queen Victoria's Jubilee. No doubt the Times will milk that dry."
Mr. Moore couldn't help but laugh.
"Right lead column all the way through the festivities. There'll be special photos on Sunday, too. My God, Sarah, doesn't it ever get boring knowing all the angles?"
"I don't know them on this case, John," Miss Howard answered as we started down Broadway.
The sounds of the carriages in the street became a bit smoother as they hit the rust pavement of the avenue, but the slight softening of the clatter didn't ease Miss Howard's edginess.
I don't mind telling you, it frightens me. There's something terrible about this business.
A few more silent seconds of apprehensive walking, and they hove into view. First, the Gothic spire of Grace Church, reaching up and above the surrounding buildings with a kind of easy majesty, then the yellow bricks and cloister-like windows of number 808. Our old headquarters was actually closer to us than Grace, bordering the churchyard on the uptown side as it did, but in that part of town you always saw the spire before anything else. Not even the ever-bright windows of McCreary's department store across Broadway, or the huge cast-iron monument to hucksterism that was the old Stewart store on 10th Street, could hold a wet match to the church. The only building that came close was number 808, and that was because it had been designed by the same architect, James Renwick, who apparently had it in mind that this little crossroads of Broadway should be a memorial to our medieval ancestors instead of a pure and simple marketplace. We approached the swirling, pretty ironwork of number 808's front door, Art Nouveau, they called it, a name that always struck me as pretty pointless, since I figured that the next artsy fellow who came along was always bound to lay claim to the Nouveau part. And then Cyrus, Mr. Moore, and I all paused before entering. It wasn't fear so much, but you have to remember that just a year ago this place had been our second, and sometimes first, home during an investigation that had seen unimaginable horrors brought to light and friends of ours mercilessly killed. Everything on Broadway looked pretty much the same as it had during those dark days. The department stores, the shadowy, ghostly yard and parish house of the church, the fine but not too fussy St. Denis Hotel across the street, also designed by Mr. Renwick, all was as it had been, and that only brought the memories more vividly to life, and so we just waited a minute before we went inside. Miss Howard seemed to sense our uncertainty, and, knowing it to be well-grounded, didn't push too hard.
"I know I'm asking a lot," she said, glancing around the street and speaking with rare uncertainty, "but I tell you, all of you, if you see this woman, talk to her for just a few minutes. Hear her describe it—"
"It's all right, Sarah," Mr. Moore interrupted, abandoning complaint and softening his voice to suit the scene. He turned first to me and then to Cyrus, as if to make sure that he was speaking for us all. We didn't need to tell him he was. "It takes a moment, that's all," he went on, looking up at the facade of number 808. "But we're with you. Lead the way."
We passed through the marble lobby and into the great cage that was the elevator, then started the slow, laborious drift up to the sixth floor. Looking at Cyrus and Mr. Moore, I could tell they knew as well as I did that, all nervousness aside, we weren't going to come back down again without having gotten into something we might regret. Part of that was our mutual friendship for Miss Howard. Part of it was, well, something that born New Yorkers just carry in their blood. A nose for the thing. Call that thing whatever name you want. The story, the case, the ride, any way you cut it, we were getting on board. Oh, sure, we could pray that it wouldn't involve the kind of devastation what the Beecham case had, but pray was all we could do, for we didn't have the power to back out now. The elevator came to the kind of heavy, sudden stop typical of commercial jobs, for number 808 was a commercial building, full of furniture builders and sweatshops. That was part of the reason Dr. Kreitzler had picked it in the first place. We'd been able to carry out our investigative affairs under the harmless cover of small businesses. But secrecy was no longer an issue for Miss Howard, and through the elevator grate I could see that she'd had a very tactful sign painted on the sixth floor door. The Howard Agency. Research Services for Women. Drawing the elevator grate aside, she unlocked the door and then held it open as we all filed in. The big expanse of the near floor-through room was dark, with only the light from the arc street lamps on Broadway and McCreary's upper windows across the street throwing any illumination inside. But that was enough to see that Miss Howard had made only a few changes in the decor of the place. The furniture, what Dr. Kreitzler had bought at an antique auction the previous year, and what had once been the property of the Marchese Luigi Carcano, still filled the room.
The divan, large mahogany table, and big easy chairs rested on the green oriental carpets in their usual spots, giving the place the sudden, unexpected feel of a home. The billiard table was now in the back by the kitchen, covered with planking and a silk drape. It wasn't the kind of thing, I figured, that would have given Miss Howard's lady clients much reassurance. But the five big office desks were still there, though Miss Howard had arranged them in a row rather than a circle, and the baby grand piano still sat in a corner by one of the Gothic windows. Seeing it, Cyrus went over and lifted its lid with a little smile, touching two keys gently, and then looking to Miss Howard.
"Still in tune,"
he said softly. She nodded and smiled back. "Still in tune." Cyrus put his bowler on the bench, sat down, and gently started to